a very famous law that's in modern controversy. It's called the law of return. That actually guarantees that every Jewish person can automatically become a citizen of the state of Israel. So Robert Frost once said that home is where they can't kick you out, where they have to let you in. And really, Israel, literally, if you're Jewish, we have to let you in. But even questions of Mayor Lansky and criminals know that Israel normally not extradite a Jewish criminal unless it's a crime of violence and the like. So no matter where you wind up living, and even if you go back to the States, God forbid, nevertheless, I hope that you'll always look at Eretz Yisrael as your home, and within Eretz Yisrael, hopefully your Samaritan will be a place that you'll feel you can come back to. You know, we have people who come back here quite a lot. You know, come back for a week, come back for a day. You know, we will set up some learning for you and some Torah for you and the like. So you're always welcome here. Hi, Shalmer.
Does anyone have tape on the
recording? I don't remember.
Are you recording?
So anyway, I don't know if there was an assigned topic today. I wanted to talk a little bit about a very general issue that sometimes people are a bit confused about. And I'm going to start off with a little discussion about Christianity. Although that will not be the focus of my remarks, but we're in the season, so to speak. And you know that the actual inventor of a religion called Christianity was not Jesus. Jesus, in his lifetime, simply claimed to be a Messiah. Jesus himself lived as a Jew, maybe he wasn't the best Jew in my perspective, but he did not identify himself as anyone other than a Jew, and his claim was he was Messiah, that God had sent him to be the Mashiach. We believe in Mashiach. He was a messianic pretender. But the real inventor of Christianity as accepted religion was Paul. Now, Paul actually never knew Jesus, in the flesh at least. But Paul, you know, describes himself as having a Jewish education. Paul, in fact, describes himself as studying with Rabbi Gamliel, who is actually mentioned in the Mishnah. And Paul had the famous epiphany on the road to Damascus, where, you know, he had some vision of Jesus who had already been crucified. Now, again, I don't necessarily have to spend a lot of time on this, but here is the point. Paul was a great, and I'm going to use the Hebrew word, mechadesh. He was a great theological innovator. Because Paul made the argument that Judaism was no longer a valid religion. It could not be valid. Because Judaism was predicated on compliance with the law. You have to follow commandments. You have to follow mitzvot. And Paul said, because man is sinful, it would be impossible for a human being to achieve salvation by following the law, because man is incapable of full compliance with the law. Therefore, Paul said, this is his kiddush, God in his mercy abrogated the law, meaning the Torah, basically, and instead substituted faith for law. If you are a student of theology, this is known as the Pauline justification by faith. Pauline is simply, not Paul's sister, simply Pauline is the doctrine of Paul. And this was the great kiddush of Christianity, that the Torah, kiddush, and Christianity acknowledges there was the Sinai revelation, and God gave the Torah to the Jewish people. They do not deny any of that, but they simply said this was superseded, and the argument was made that the law became too onerous because human beings are not capable of compliance with the law, and therefore faith in Jesus substituted for compliance with the law. This was, by the way, was not totally accepted. There were some early Christians, such as Peter, who actually took the position that you have to keep mitzvot, kashrus and Shabbos and circumcision, and just believe in Jesus as the Messiah, but Paul's view eventually became the dominant view of Christianity. Now, Paul basically is making two points, and really what I want to talk to you today about is how does Judaism address and refute the two points that Paul makes. First of all, Paul says, human beings are not capable of perfection, so it's not possible that God would say, you have to perfect yourself by the law, because we're too weak. The yetzer hara, the evil inclination, is too strong within man. The second point he made was that the most important thing that God cares about is your heart and your feelings and your emotions. Why would God care about the trivialities of whether you recite the Shema, let's give an example, you know, before 9 o'clock in the morning, or whether you ripped your toilet paper on Shabbat, and all of those things. You don't use them. He didn't use these particular examples, but this was his argument. Isn't the most important thing to be a good person? So essentially, what Christianity did was, it kind of threw out all the detailed rules and regulations, and simply said, God wants us to focus on fundamental values, be a good person. Now, this is a question that people raise even today, not from a Christian perspective. People basically say, why is Judaism so fixated on legalism? By legalism, I mean, everything seems to be quantified with a great deal of specificity. In other words, we could have said, for example, Shabbat, day of rest, you know, spend time with your family, have a good dinner, have a good nap, and, you know, if you want to listen to a movie, go to the mall, pick up your iPhone, that's your business. And yet, Judaism kind of goes with 39 categories of work, meaning some people say, isn't there a contradiction between legalism and spirituality? So all of this is an issue that many people have, meaning they kind of say, hey, all of this halakha system, halakha is a Jewish law, seems to contradict spirituality because I want to focus on, you know, my heart, my emotions, my feelings. And that's really what Paul said as well. So here, I just want to point out a few points. Again, these are random points, but I think together they come together in a meaningful way. That is, you understand that Paul is painting an amazingly pessimistic understanding of human nature. Paul is basically saying, you, me, all of us, we are so depraved and so decrepit. There is no way we can truly perfect ourselves by virtuous action. And since there is no way we can perfect ourselves by virtuous action, you might as well forget it. Drop all that stuff and simply believe in Jesus and you're going to be saved. And a point, of course, the idea of original sin is fundamentally a Christian doctrine and the like. Judaism is a great religion of hope, a religion of optimism. We can strive for perfection. Now, we're not gonna say we're going to make it, because we're always going to fall short. But you know what the old saying goes, if you reach for the stars, at least you'll get yourself out of the mud. And Judaism is profoundly optimistic in the sense that it does say, yes, you can make yourself better. You can make the world better. You can make society better. You can make a difference. Now, that doesn't mean it's without struggle. We don't have a doctrine called original sin, per se, but we do believe that within every human being there are impulses towards egotism, towards selfishness, towards self-aggrandizement, arrogance, power, and that is what we call Yetzer Hara. I'm sure you've heard the phrase, the evil inclination. But that's not who fundamentally I am. That is simply urges that God has put into me, if you want to call it the id, according to Freud, and that's simply to create the battleground by which I exercise my capacity of free will. And God has given me the strength to be victorious in that struggle. So point number one is that paradoxically, as apparently burdensome as you might think the halakhic structure is, it rests on a profoundly optimistic view of life and human nature. As opposed to Paul that said, what's the use of doing all that stuff? I'm going to fail anyway. Judaism says, what do you mean? Failure is not inevitable. We might even say failure is not an option, as they said in the Apollo space missions. Rather, you can do it. That's an important point. Sometimes we think the halakha is, you know, so depressing, so many things to do, everybody's wearing black, you know, whatever it is. But really, underlying the whole philosophy of how we argue with Paul is that Paul's view of life was severely depressing, ultimately. And our view of life is very optimistic, and to use a modern term, it is empowering. We are not this helpless little thing who's not capable of making a difference in the world. God gave us a lot of power. In fact, that's really the implication of being in the image of God, that God gave us certain aspects of divinity. That's one thing. But at the same time, there's a paradox in Judaism. On one hand, the Jewish view of human personality is profoundly optimistic. On the other hand, it is also profoundly realistic, meaning to say the following. God says, you, when I say you, I mean me, everybody, man, woman, we all have this enormous potential for good. But realistically, we have the Eitzahara that can mislead us. Very, very often, our judgments are distorted. Very often, we will define good in terms of what is convenient for us, what, you know, taps into our desires and the like. And therefore, if God were to simply say, be a good person, and then leave it to you to define what's good, well, you know, I'd cut corners here and there, I would tend to rest. We have an infinite capacity for delusion and self-rationalization. And therefore, God, who knows us quite well because he made us, God basically says, you know, I'm not just going to leave it to you to figure out what the rules of the road are. I'm going to give you guidance, direction, structure. So the point I'm making, perhaps in too many words, is that the so-called legalistic nature of Judaism is based on two premises. One is the profoundly optimistic view of man as capable of engaging in virtuous actions and making a difference. But on the other hand, a very healthy suspicion of our capacity of self-delusion, which requires that our directions be given with some precision and specificity instead of being left to general values. After all, the Christian world really hasn't done that well with general values of love and care. They brought us the Crusades. To some degree, they brought us the Holocaust, although that's a bit controversial. This is the Holocaust. Christianity is still a controversial topic and the like. And you understand.
Okay.
Sorry. Oh, that's right. Okay. So you understand that human beings need guidance. Now, and again, in a way, the easiest analogy is how you raise children. Right? You're not going to tell your five-year-old, be a good boy. I mean, you might say it's a phrase. You know, you haven't told them exactly what to do. So, in a sense, God has given us directions. Now, that's enormously comforting, but I want to make another point. You know, years ago, you know, I think Rabbi Mendel mentioned I attended the Harvard Law School. By the way, don't be that impressed with it. If you're probably not anyway, but I'm sure many of you were in equally good schools. But you know, on my block, when I lived in Silver Spring, there were at least five other Orthodox people on the block who went to Harvard Law School. So, you know, quite a few religious people do get into these good schools. I was lucky because everybody's a lawyer anyway there. But the thing was, the first person I met, my very first day as a law student, Alan Dershowitz, who was a professor at Harvard, still is, went over to me because he saw I was wearing a kippah, and he introduced himself to me, and he said, you know, I know that you're an Orthodox student. If there's anything I can do to help you, I'll be very, very happy to do it. Which was very, very nice. I never had the occasion to talk to him for the next 3 years, but he did introduce himself. But what's interesting is, many, many years later, I don't think he remembered me, because he really only met me once, but many years later, I was a last-minute substitute to debate him at a certain event. I think it was about separation of church and state or something. And, you know, he came in very hostile because he saw I was an Orthodox. I had a beard then. I didn't have a beard at the time. And, but my wife even told me he came in with very combative body language. You know. But then I told my little story about how Alan Dershowitz was the only person who went over to me when I first day at law school. She said you could see it softening, that he was respected. But the reason I'm bringing this up was because he made a point. You know, he used to be Orthodox. That's the interesting thing. He actually comes from an Orthodox family, and he went to Yeshiva High School, so he actually studied he had a yeshiva education through high school, so he knew how to learn some Gemara and the like. So he made the point, I'm not like the Orthodox Jews here. I study Talmud too, but I use my mind. They just open the book. And that just tells them what to do, and they don't think through things. They just follow life mechanically. As opposed to me, he says, I am a thinker. I take all of these ideas, and I filter them through my intellect and the like. And that's a bit of a caricature, because it's true. And I think he knew it was a caricature. You know, it's true that there are so many rules. But you have to understand that these are parameters. Halachic life does not mean you put your mind on hold. Yes, so a halakha just means Jewish law. Literally it means the path. Sounds a little colder. The path. Right? But basically that's it, because God has given us a road. And when you have a road with signs as direction, you know, you can confidently go to your destination without getting lost. So Jewish law generally, there are many terms we can use for Jewish law, but halakha, which is the path, is a very common term that we use. In fact, if you're interested in seeing halakha discussed in English on a very advanced level, how it applies to modern technology and all sorts of problems, there is a series of, so far, six books, but you know, the series is ongoing, called Contemporary Halakhic Problems. It has to be in the title, and the author is Rabbi J is the initial, J. David Bleich, B-L-E-I-C-H. Absolutely superb treatment of halakha on a very, very advanced level, but written in English. He is both a very eminent rabbi and a law professor himself, so he kind of is able to draw on all of those disciplines, as well as a philosopher and a theologian. So here's the thing. Halakha, on one hand, is full of details, to be sure, but you have to understand, it does not take away the responsibility of thinking. It does not take away the difficulty of ethical judgment. I have parameters. I have boundaries. I have to work within a certain field. But that field is quite, quite broad. In other words, Dershowitz's portrayal that halakhic Jews simply follow rules automatically, and every time they're deciding, do I buy Cheerios or cornflakes for breakfast, I just look up the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, and that tells me what to do, is really a gross oversimplification. Okay, and this brings me to, so basically, my first point, which I guess you knew before you came in here, is we are not Christians, right? Just like John Kennedy said, I am a Berliner, we can confidently say, I am not a Christian. You're not a Christian either. Right? But the basic idea is, because number one, the two mistakes, as far as we're concerned, that Paul's theology made was, number one, he denied the potential perfectibility of human nature. But number two, he thought it was sufficient to have general guidelines without specific guidance, when in fact, human beings are capable of such infinite rationalization. And again, I don't want to prove things from anecdotes. You can always put forward an anecdote, but again, maybe I shouldn't describe the Holocaust as an anecdote. But for example, let's take a civilization like Germany. Now, Germany was by far the most civilized culture in Europe in terms of producing music, art, science, literature. And many of the Nazis, some of the leaders of the Nazis were indeed simply pathological sociopaths, so there's no question. But on the other hand, many of the people who participated in the brutality of the concentration camps were educated, cultured people who literally would not hurt a fly. We have pictures of people who spent the day shooting and burning men, women, and children, and then they would go home and feed their cats and take care of their dogs, and then go to the opera and cry over the poetry of Schiller and the music of Beethoven. And how do you kind of do that? How do you spend the day in brutal killing and then, you know, crying over the emotions of love and the like? Kind of very, very strange. And part of this goes, because this really is a lesson in how much we can fool ourselves. In fact, there's a famous speech by Goebbels, who's the propaganda minister, and that he says it takes a very special person who has a heart and an emotion to be able to do this difficult killing that we have to do. And this is a tribute to your strength of character, that in spite of your great compassion and love of humanity, you do what you need to do. But the way this worked is that there was a process of dehumanization. They convinced themselves that Jews are not human. They are simply vermin that have the physical features of human beings. And the same way you've got to kill, you know, malaria, bearing mosquitoes, and the like, you have to do this. Which means, the bottom line is, you can convince yourself of anything. And that's why God says, hey, I'm not going to tell you just be a good person. I'm going to tell you how to be a good person. Because otherwise, you could twist goodness to mean killing Jews is a great virtue. Or if not Jews, whoever it is you're going to kill or destroy. Or the ends justify the means. Or robbing it. It's okay to rob from the rich to give to the poor because the rich don't deserve it. Or even people who are acting for a moral cause. It's okay to bomb an abortion clinic and kill, you know, 30 people in order to prevent abortion. Or suicide bombing against innocent men, women, and children as part of our freedom fight. So God says, if I just tell you to be good, not quite enough. I need to give you guidance. But the guidance is broad enough that we still have to engage with our critical faculties and the like. So, as I said, the virtuous caricature was very, very unfair. And I had a feeling he knew he was being unfair, but he wanted to make his debating points and the like. Okay. Now, having said this, I want to talk a little bit about the idea of Torah. Again, I don't know how familiar your vocabulary is. Halakha, some of these are going to be synonyms. They're not going to be sharply different words. Halakha, the path, is generally Jewish law that tells me how to live my life within parameters. And by the way, before I get to Torah, I'm not sure if you fully understand how broad Jewish law is. If I were to ask a person out the street, you know, Jewish law, what is Jewish law concerned with? So you might think, well, Jewish law is concerned with kashrut, you know, what can we eat? Jews are always connected to food, both in the positive and the negative. Right? What can we eat? What can't we eat? When do we eat? You know, when can't we eat? Right? We have days that we don't stop eating and days that we have to stop eating, right? Whatever it would be. In fact, this was Larry King's hardening authority in Judaism, although that was to be Jewish. Larry King's brief description of the Jewish holiday cycle. He says, they tried to destroy us, we won, let's eat. So, okay, as virtuous, at least being short and sweet. So we would think that what does Jewish law embrace? The laws of keeping kosher, the laws of the Sabbath, the laws of the holidays, prayer services, how you run a synagogue, etc. A Pesach, a Passover Seder, Hanukkah candles. All of that is fine, because those are religious activities. Those are ways you celebrate your rebirth. But do you realize there is a Jewish law of business ethics? There is a Jewish law of contracts, of partnerships, of how you run your profession, how you deal with no competition clauses, how do you deal with illegal downloading? Right? Issues of YouTube, right? All of these issues. You might think, well, that has nothing to do with Judaism. That's just general copyright law and everything. No, no, no. There are Jewish principles that if you're a religious Jew, you look to halakha, what is permitted, right? So one has to remember that, in a sense, even the term religion is an artificial limiter. Judaism is not religion. Judaism is life. Halakha is the path you walk in living your life. How I relate to my wife, how I parent my children, how my children relate to me. Of course, that's in the Ten Commandments, to honor your father and your mother. And there's a whole portion of the Jewish code of law that deals with business transactions and the like. You know, they tell a story where a rabbi once went over to a very wealthy congregant And he said, you know, you always ask me questions about Sabbath and holidays and kosher, but you never ask me questions about how you run your business. And these are also within the ambit of Jewish law. And the businessman was annoyed. He said to the rabbi, Rabbi, I don't tell you how to do your business. Don't tell me how to do mine. But that's, again, a false dichotomy. Okay, so halakha is all-encompassing. Medical ethics, maybe we'll have occasion to talk about this. Organ donations, cloning, confidentiality, autopsies. These are Jewish law questions. Jewish law addresses everything because God wants us to follow His will in every aspect of our life. Okay. So this is called halakha. Okay? Halakha. Or the more yeshiva pronunciation is halakha. You'll notice that yeshiva pronunciation is primarily based on Yiddish as opposed to Hebrew. So for example, in Hebrew, we call the seventh day Shabbat. And in the Yiddish pronunciation, Shabbos. But say the same word. One is the Yiddish and one is modern Hebrew. But okay. But be it as it may, what are the sources of halakha? So here we move into something that is called Torah. Now, what does the word Torah literally mean? Torah literally means instruction, guidance. Actually, somewhat similar to halakha. Halakha is path, Torah is guidance. But, now if you are sensitive to language, you'll hear the word Torah being used a zillion times in the time that you're here for studying Torah. But if you're attuned to subtleties, you might be a little confused, although maybe you've noticed already, because we sometimes use it to refer to slightly different things, maybe significant different things. We sometimes talk about halakha and Torah synonymous. So a person says, I live a Torah life, or I follow Torah Judaism. In which case, that's simply a synonym, I follow halakhic Judaism. Like the old labels, Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, those are more political labels. Really, what most people call Orthodox Judaism simply means I follow halakha, I follow the halakhic system. So we say I follow Torah Judaism, that might be. And of course, within this Orthodox Judaism, there are many variations. There's Hasidic and many types of Hasidic. And there's even modern left-wing orthodoxy and open orthodoxy. These are gradations and labels that are ultimately not that important for us. Okay. So sometimes Torah is just a synonym for halakha. Other times, Torah refers to a specific book. We know that Judaism, we have our Bible. The Christians refer to our Bible as the Old Testament. And their Bible they call the New Testament. Those are not terms that Jews are comfortable with, although I sometimes use New Testament as I talk myself. But technically, that's not a good way of speaking, because the New Testament is based on the idea that the Old has been superseded and replaced, and we do not believe that, of course. So instead of New Testament, you could talk about the Christian Bible. But the Jewish Bible has three parts, and the Hebrew word for the Jewish Bible is Tanakh. And Tanakh is an abbreviation. The T, or the Tav, stands for Torah, meaning the five books of Moses. The Nun, or the N sound, is Nevi'im, the books of the prophets. Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, Isaiah, Jeremiah, the famous prophets. And then, the third, the Kaf sound, is Ketuvim, assorted writings. And that includes like the story of Esther, the Psalms, Proverbs, and the like. So, the first of that trilogy is Torah, the five books of Moses, and that is in the scroll that we keep in the ark. And that's called a Sefer Torah, the book of the Torah. That is the commandment. See, the prophets and the writings contain very important history and very important ethical teachings. So they are certainly a vital part of Judaism. And in a generic way, we include that in Torah when we mean the way a Jew lives. But technically, the technical narrow definition of Torah is the five books of Moses. Right, and those five books, which are the scroll, and that's the only thing you'll have is the scroll of the Torah, the Torah scroll. The five books of Moses, as you know, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and they contain the commandments, mitzvot, commandments that God has given us. There's a total of 613, although most of them do not apply today, so don't get too afraid. There's only around 100 that apply today. Now, and of course the Torah is a combination of history and law. The creation of the world, the flood story of Noah, the stories of Abraham, Isaac, Joseph and his brothers that we're just finishing up now, the story of the Jews in Egypt and their redemption from Egypt, and their wandering in the desert for 40 years under the leadership of Moshe. Like all of those great, important historical stories are in the Torah. But the Torah ends before we get to the land of Israel. Right? We don't get to the land of Israel until after Moses' death. The Torah itself is the chronicle of the creation of the Jewish people and the receiving of the Ten Commandments, taking us all the way until Moses' death before we enter the land of Israel. And all commandments are derived from the Torah. But here is the claim that Judaism makes. We believe that there are actually two Torahs. We believe there is the written Torah, which are the five books of Moses that were written down. But we believe that side by side with that written Torah, God communicated to Moses an oral tradition that explains and amplifies and elaborates on the meaning of that written Torah. So I don't want to overwhelm you with Hebrew. Some of you may know these words already. But because of this bifurcated Torah, we talk about it as Torah Shebiktav, which in Hebrew simply means the written Torah. That's what you're going to see in the Ark. And then we have, side by side with the written Torah, we have Torah Shebaal Ba'al Peh, the oral Torah. And the need for an oral Torah is very apparent because many, many verses in the written Torah cannot be properly understood without a supplementary oral tradition. The Torah says, if I punch you and knock out your tooth, or God forbid, knock out an arm, right? So the written Torah says in the book of Exodus, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. This is the infamous Lex Talionis. For those who know Latin, that just means the law of retaliation. And yet, the oral Torah tells us things are not always what they seem. And in fact, an eye for an eye is not interpreted to mean I knock out your tooth, you knock out my tooth. But it means I have to compensate you for your loss of limb. Okay, how do you measure? In the United States, how do you measure any legal, how does any legal system measure loss of limb? But it is a compensatory mechanism and the like. You only know that from the oral tradition. The Torah says, do not do work on the Sabbath day. Well, what does work mean? Maybe it means I don't go to work, but I can go to the mall, go to the beach, drive my car. The oral tradition tells you the specific types of things you don't do. You don't write, you don't type. You only know that from the oral tradition. You don't know that from the written text itself. And this creates some anomalies, by the way. I remember years ago when I was in seventh grade, quite a long time ago, shortly after the first Shabbos was given by God. the second Shabbos of creation. No, but I remember that I was once, I went to a Jewish school. I was fortunate in that way. But the majority of my classmates, this was in Hartford, Connecticut, anyone's from New England, but the majority of my classmates were not Shabbos observers, because that was the nature of the community. So I was once walking to a friend's bar mitzvah. I had to walk like 5 miles. It was a long walk. And a number of people, including teachers of the school, they were driving and they stopped on the way, offered me a ride, and the like. It was a hot summer day. And think about the absurdity of this, although it's very, very fascinating. And they said, can I give you a ride if you're walking in the heat? And I said, well, I can't go into the car today because I'm not allowed to do work on the Sabbath. So instead of going into a car, air-conditioned car, which would be get me to the synagogue in 2 minutes, I'm walking 5 miles in the heat without water because I have to avoid doing prohibited labor. Now, one would think that the labor of walking 5 miles is a lot more laborious than sitting in an air-conditioned car. But the answer, once again, is that the Aurelon teaches us, and remember, we need a whole other talk about this, that the concept of labor is not physical exertion. You're right. Walking in the heat is a lot more physical exertion than sitting in a car. But the concept of labor is mastery and dominion over nature. Because since God created the world in 6 days and rested on the Sabbath, you must refrain from exercising your mastery over nature to acknowledge that God is the source of creation. So the touchstone of what is work in Shabbat is not how physically hard it is, but how much control and dominion are you asserting over God's world. That's why the old chestnut that people always said, you know, the Torah says, you cannot start a fire in Shabbat. So we say, I'm not allowed to turn on a light because electric lights are like fire. But people will tell you, I'm sure you've heard this, well, in the olden days, to make a fire, you had to rub, you know, 2 stones together and it took 3 hours. You were so tired. How could flipping a switch be considered to be doing work? But the answer, once again, is, if anything, maybe it's more work, more malacha in the concept of mastery over nature. Okay. But be as it has. But I'm not here to talk about Shabbat. Now we'll talk about it later in the week. But I'm here just to show you what the oral law teaches us that you don't know from the written law itself. A third example. The Torah says, and this is in the Shema, this is the famous paragraph of Shema that Jews read twice a day. You shall tie the words of God between your eyes and put them on your hand, literally. Now, what is it that you're supposed to tie? First of all, this is my hand, and between my eyes is here. Now, I look at the English, and I see, oh, what am I supposed to put on myself? Phylacteries. Well, what on earth are phylacteries? Nobody knows what phylacteries. I mean, it's like, you know, the translation of tefillin is phylactery, so all we know is, oh, phylacteries must be tefillin. I mean, the Greek word is hardly very helpful. But if you look at tefillin are the prototypical mysterious black box. Actually, that mysterious black box, very important black box, that contain paragraphs of the Torah. It's as if you're putting the words of the Torah in your brain and in your physical strength and in your heart. But tefillin has many laws. Gotta be black. Gotta be square. Gotta be leather. The written Torah doesn't tell you anything about this. You only know it from the oral law. There's a lot of stuff. If all you had was the written Torah, we simply wouldn't know what to do. Sukkot. Right? Do you guys take Lulav and Esrog? You're familiar with that? Right? Now the Torah says, on Sukkot, you take the fruit of a beautiful tree. Oh, fruit of a beautiful tree. An apple, a persimmon, a peach, an apricot? What on earth is the fruit of a beautiful tree? How do we know it's this yellow thing that we call an Esrog? Only because of an oral tradition. A lot of things. The Torah itself makes reference to an oral tradition. When the Torah commands us, you know, in order to eat kosher meat, it has to be slaughtered a certain way, you know, it has to be killed a certain way. This is called shechita. If you simply shoot it or stun it or electrocute it, it's not kosher. Even if it's a kosher animal, like a cow, it has to be slaughtered by severing the arteries of the neck, the trachea, and the esophagus, and some of the arteries on the side of the neck. This is called shechita, and it's a very detailed process. The Torah says the following, you shall slaughter your animals in accordance with the procedure that I have commanded you. This is in the text. The problem is there is no procedure that is otherwise described. Where do I look for that? Answer, this is a very interesting example of where the written text itself is telling you there's some oral instructions that come along. So this is a very, very important idea of the, we'll call it the bifurcated Torah, the twofold Torah, the written Torah, the oral Torah. Without the oral Torah, we literally wouldn't know what to do. Now, there were movements in Judaism that rejected the oral tradition, and they only wanted to follow the written Torah exactly. The most famous of those movements are still around today, but very, very small. Very, very small. But they try to have some type of presence. They are called the Karaites. And they take everything literally. So when the Torah says on Shabbat, a man shall not leave his house on the Shabbat, which we interpret under the oral law, simply means don't carry things unless you're in an enclosed area like a neighbor, they say, no, I got to lock myself in my house on Shabbat and the like. Or when the Torah says do not have fire in Shabbat, which the oral law says don't start a fire, but you can certainly set up a fire before Shabbat, and that's the meaning of shalosh. A shalosh is also one of the most important fundamental principles of Judaism. Right? No shalosh. Shalosh is the overnight stew. And why do we do that? Because there's a mitzvah to enjoy the Shabbat. And you can't really enjoy unless you have hot food, but you're not allowed to cook in Shabbat. You're not allowed to start a fire in Shabbat. So the genius of Jewish culinary arts invented this slow cooking stew that you set up before Shabbat and it cooks. But if you're a paradise, you can't do that because the paradise don't have, they don't allow any fire to be used on Shabbat at all. Right? So there were the Karaites. In fact, there's even in Jerusalem, now I haven't checked this out, but I remember hearing years ago, a Karaite synagogue. And I understand what I heard years ago, not in the old city, but I heard years ago that they were cursed that they will never have a minion. They will never have the requisite 10 people. So like every time they occasionally get a Karaite convert, somebody else dies. So they always stay at 9, I think, for their services. Of course, on the other hand, I don't even know why they need 10, because the requirement of a minion is part of the oral law. Right? So maybe it's quite excessive. Hey, you guys don't need a minion, you don't believe in the oral law, and the like. But the Karaites, as I say, were a breakaway sect. And in fact, if you look at them historically, it's very, very interesting. The founder of the Karaites was a man, Anan ben David, who lived in the 10th century. Almost 1,000 years after the Torah was given. Right? So, he just made up this idea, we don't accept. And you see very, very clearly that this was a politically motivated schism. It was not a religiously motivated schism, because basically, he was in line to actually become head of a great rabbinical academy. He didn't get the job, so he simply rejected the whole oral tradition and said, okay, I'm ignoring. I mean, it's an amazing thing. He would have been. He was like second in line to become a great rabbinic expositor. And he didn't get the job, so he just looked like that. So it's clearly that there was no theological foundation for Karaitism. It was based on political schism. For those who are interested, the one who did get the job was Rav Sajagon, one of the great leaders, and that caused the great schism of Karaites and Rabbanites, as they were called. I think it's Adnan is the first name. And I think Ben David, I believe, is Adnan Ben David. Just like Muhammad, a very similar thing happened with Muhammad. Now, Muhammad was a camel driver. And Muhammad knew many, many Jews, and Muhammad had a very good imagination, very rich imagination, and he loved all the midrashim. The rabbis would tell stories from their Bible, not the rabbis, the Jews that he knew, would tell him stories from the Bible and stories from the rabbis. And Muhammad really loved all of these stories, and he wanted to become Jewish. He wanted to become Jewish, and for whatever reason, he was not deemed a suitable candidate for conversion. So he decided to start his own religion, simply because he was not accepted. It tells you that sometimes rejecting somebody can have a pretty pretty severe class. Okay. Someone had a hand up?
I didn't. So the written law since anyway, it's been very well documented.
Yes.
Torahs are all, I think, five letters are understood to be, is what I've heard.
Right.
How do we know that the oral law is as well kept as the Torah law?
Yes, yes. So I'm glad you talk about that. That's actually the main theme I want to talk about. We're almost finished here because I have to leave. But the basic idea is this. First of all, I want to discuss a number of interrelated questions. First of all, why did God give the Torah in a bifurcated way? Why didn't we just get everything in writing? That's one issue. The second issue is, how can we assume the accuracy, your question, of the translation?
Right, again, telephone.
That's the one thing here is the thing. Number one, part of how we can assume the accuracy of the oral tradition, I'll just give you one thing to think about, is that it's come down to us from many, many different sources. Just as, for example, part of how we know the veracity of the written Torah is that you have thousands, maybe tens of thousands of Torah scrolls, and subject to maybe five letters, they are all identical. So too, oral traditions came down from many schools in Babylonia, many schools in Israel, many schools in Europe, with the substantial principles the same. And as a result, that itself, each one is like a check and balance on the other. But what I do want to raise this question, that is, I don't know if you guys have studied Talmud yet or are going to study Talmud. I'm sure you're going to study Talmud. I'm not going to talk about what Talmud is because there's a lot of different words here. One of the things you will uncover right away is the Talmud, which is really the written record of the oral law. The oral law eventually got written down. Is filled with argument, disagreement, and debate. Rabbi X says kosher, Rabbi Y says not kosher, Rabbi X says pure, Rabbi Y says impure, Rabbi X says liable, Rabbi Y says exempt. And here, your question may come to the fore here, and that's, well, wait a second here. God gives Moses this oral law. So God gives Moses a particular answer to a particular question. So how can some people say the answer is one thing and some people say the answer is the other thing? Doesn't that indicate somebody's wrong? Doesn't it indicate that somebody didn't get the message right? And if somebody didn't get the message right, then maybe nobody got the message right. Maybe we're playing the game of telephone. In other words, in short, there are a lot of questions I want to talk about here because they're all interrelated. But one of the major questions is, how can we believe that the oral law was divinely transmitted to Moses and passed down if indeed we see there is so much debate and disagreement regarding its premises? Isn't that in and of itself proof of inaccuracy of tradition? That is an excellent question. I'm going to not answer that now, but keep that, no, keep, hold that question, and we're going to talk about it. Okay, I will cover it. Okay. So I think this is where I, and again, my other, so really I have two goals in our sessions here. One is to try to address these questions. The other is, I just want you to become a little bit Jewishly literate in understanding the difference between oral law, Mishnah, Talmud. On one hand, the Mishnah Talmud contains the oral law, but it is not the same as the oral law and the like. But in the few moments I have, I just want to address one single question. And that is, why did God utilize the medium of oral transmission for so much of the Torah? Why didn't he simply put everything in writing? Yeah. Oh, you want to say that? Oh, okay. So let me just say the following. There are a few interesting perspectives, but one answer might be that God wanted to create a mechanism that requires human interaction to understand Judaism. And that is, you know, we live in the information age, we live in the internet age, and everything is now virtual communities. You don't even have to go to synagogue, you get a virtual synagogue. They even have these role-playing games, what's it, Farm, whatever, they have one of these games where you kind of, what do you call it? I don't remember.
Farm Fargo.
Yeah, all that stuff. And, you know, and people are committing suicide because they lost, I lost my whole fortune, and, you know, the whole make-believe fortune. I lost my house, you know, whatever it is. And then, actually, it's not even a laughing matter. You had those teenage girls who killed a classmate because Slender Man, which is apparently some type of internet figure, they actually believed that he was real and he was commanding them to do evil things. And then they're very, very serious mind games that are happening here with a distortion of reality. But putting aside the pathological cases, you know, we're so dependent on computers, on technology. You know, we have these jokes that the only way husband and wife talk to each other over the dinner table is if they text each other. You know, each one around their iPhone or whatever it is. And God wants you to make a system where you're not going to just get your Judaism from books. You need to have a flesh and blood teacher. And that's for two reasons. Number one, Judaism is not only about information. It is about feeling, emotion, passion, connection. The cold, written, printed page or handwritten page, whatever it would be, maybe it communicates data, but it doesn't communicate feeling and passion. Remember, God said, I'm keeping a lot of the Torah oral. So you'll have to get it from a person. Now, in some ways, we're suffering from that because now a lot of the oral tradition is written down, and indeed we suffer from that. But even today, when so much of it is written down, that's why you're here. You still need the flesh and blood connection. The other thing is, the old saying, one picture is worth a thousand words. You know, if you've ever had, maybe this is a problem I have, but I think other people have it as well. You know, technical writing, you know, you have to assemble a computer or assemble a bookcase or a bicycle. Technical writing is very, very difficult to follow. You know, if you have to write a description of how you tie your shoelaces, you know, at least for me, I would not be able to follow. Do the loop and drape this over here. And you know, it's what's up. Now, if I see something, how did I learn to tie my shoes? I just, you know, watched somebody do it. Then I was able to do it. Right? So in many, many ways, you know, verbal descriptions of things are very difficult to communicate the fullness of an experience. So that the oral law basically says you're going to have to learn by watching people, by observing people. Even Shabbat, to this very day. You can learn all the laws of Shabbat. And your mind will have some type of picture of what it's like. But until you see people actually doing it, you're really not going to know what it means. So the oral law, again, guarantees that you will learn by lived and shared experience, and not just by looking up. You know, I'll give you a very brief example. You know, you all remember the old Soviet Union, you know, disintegrated. And during the years of communist rule in Soviet Union, Jews were persecuted. They were not really allowed to keep the commandments, although some courageous Jews did so privately. So there were Jews who didn't have teachers, they didn't have rabbis, but they were able to learn about Judaism from some books that were smuggled in. So a rabbi told me he once saw a very courageous Jew making the Kiddush Friday night, but he didn't pick up the Kiddush cup. He just, you know, the cup was in front of him. And the rabbi said, why don't you pick up the Kiddush cup? He said, well, in the book that I studied from, you know, he didn't mention it. It just said you make the Kiddush Friday night. Now, why didn't the book mention you pick up the Kiddush? Well, because every person who's ever seen Kiddush knows that's what you do. You don't have to say everything. But what about somebody who never saw anybody make Kiddush? meaning, you can't explain everything in writing. There are certain things you've got to assume. But if you see a person make Kiddush once, you understand. Right? It's a very interesting example. A lot of Judaism, to use a fancy word, is mimetic. Mimetic basically means you learn from seeing people do things. Of course, you have to be careful you pick the right teachers. What people are doing is not correct, but you know, if you have a reliable guide. So my suggestion here is, the reason why God kept the Torah oral, a lot of Torah oral, is for two reasons. Number one, because by requiring a human interaction and not just a virtual community, you are communicating not just data, but passion and feeling and enthusiasm. And number two, you're also maximizing the accuracy of the data by allowing people to see how it's done and not simply figure it out from the words and the like. So although you are correct that orality has a risk of the telephone game, but on the other hand, on a one-to-one basis, it is actually a greater maximizer of accuracy than the written word, because the person sees exactly how it's supposed to be done. Showing you could be a better teacher than, in fact, I've often said, when we teach the laws of Shabbat, we ought to have a model kitchen next to us. There's a lot of laws of Shabbat about cooking, complexities, and the like, and, you know, I can describe it, but if you have an actual kitchen and you see, you know, what you do and what you can't do, that would be a better teacher than simply looking up the rules in a book. Okay? But again, we're going to continue with this because it's important stuff, and hopefully it will at least give you supplementary information in terms of matching up with your other stuff. The one thing that you're going to notice, once again, just repeating this, is that in spite of the idea that everything seems to be supposed to come from God, Judaism is filled with debates, discussions, arguments. The old saying, two Jews, three opinions, happens to be very true. Talmudic study is all about debate and discussion. In fact, it's a little off-putting for people sometimes when they begin this, because they expect, oh, I'm going to open up the Talmud and get an answer to all my questions. Nope, long book. You're not going to get an answer to your questions, you're going to get another 100 questions to think about. Because in many, many ways, and this, I'll just end here, this goes back to my argument with Professor Gershwin. In many, many ways, Talmudic study is not about getting answers. It's about raising questions and thinking about them. Okay, that is the idea. That is the richness of how we connect to God. We connect to God by our virtuous deeds, and we connect to God by thinking, debating, arguing, analyzing. Okay? Jews used to be what the Koreans are today, right? Now, there's even Jews who are very far from tradition. They had a love of knowledge, a love of learning, a love of debate. Now, that may have manifested itself in secular ways, but where that comes from is, deep in the Jewish consciousness is, this is the study of Torah. This is what Torah learning is about. So Torah learning is fundamentally very interactive. It's not simply about, we're giving you all this great knowledge. It's about you bringing your own individuality to the forefront. The question is, how do you reconcile that with the notion of God's revelation? So we will talk about this. You all have a really good day. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for your time. All right, looking forward to the next few days.